Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. Tim Hagel is with us in our Iowa City studio, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Welcome back to you, Tim.
Hey there.
And we'll be pursuing a number of political developments this week, as we like to do on all of our Politics Wednesdays. A little bit later in the program, I'll ask Tim and Donna about this meeting between the president and the Democratic leaders, Pelosi and Schumer, about an infrastructure plan. Tomorrow is the National Day of Prayer, so we'll ask about the intersection of faith and politics. These sweeping new rules proposed by the president for asylum seekers. Also, Joe Biden swinging through Iowa this week. And think as I speak, Joe Biden just a few blocks from our Iowa City studio. We'll talk about Joe Biden's candidacy, just a few days old officially anyway. Of course, a long thought to be throwing his hat into the ring. Join our conversation on any of these topics today or others if you'd like to talk about the caucus primary season, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Well, the ongoing bar testimony, Donna and Tim, the Attorney General appearing in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, answering questions on Mueller's report. This is the first time that he's appeared before Congress before making the partially redacted version of the report public. Yesterday, we learned that the special counsel Bob Mueller, objected to the Attorney General's view of Russia inquiry. According to several sources tapped by the New York Times, in a letter from the special counsel to the attorney general, Mueller wrote that Barr's summary of his office's work failed to capture, quote, the context, nature, and substance of his report and had left the public confused about critical aspects of the results. Donna, what are you seeing in, I don't know how much you've been able to watch the testimony this morning in D.C. and this letter coming on right on the eve of that testimony.
Sure. I've not been able to watch any of Barr's testimony this morning, but what was available this morning, of course, the Washington Post broke this story yesterday evening. What was available this morning was Mueller's letter that was at issue that Washington Post story quoted from, but the whole letter hadn't been released until this morning, I believe. So I have read that. And, you know, one of the things I think that letter makes clear, it's relatively short, is that there was kind of some significant back and forth between Barr and Mueller about the nature of what the attorney general was saying and what Mueller had provided him with. And as I understand it from reading just a little bit of the reporting on Barr's testimony, Barr, I think, was hammering the point that when asking Mueller in a phone conversation, perhaps, you know, did he say anything incorrect? Mueller said he didn't. But, you know, in reading that letter, what is really clear is that, you know, Barr is saying, I didn't say anything wrong. And Mueller's saying, you didn't say enough. Mm. You didn't put it in the context. More needed to be said. It's like a sin of omission, I suppose you could liken it to. And so there's a differing opinion there in terms of what that should, how that should be characterized. And, you know, one of the things that Mueller makes a point of talking about in the letter is essentially that he provided the attorney general with summaries that were ready to go, had a few redactions in them, but these executive summaries that we had heard about previously and that he wanted them to be released. They had apparently talked about it multiple times, but Barr chose to do his own rollout of that information.
Right. And these summaries, plural summaries, these would have been in the different aspects. One would have been to the collusion, the conspiracy charge there, claim. One would have been what, to the obstruction. One would have been to, I guess, election security, various, a lot
the
of.
The various sections of the
And report, so they were ready to go. It. These summaries were ready to go as prepared by Mueller's team. And then they were not shared with the public Instead, the Attorney General had his own four-page summary of it. Tim Hagel, what is your view on this?
Well, pretty much along the same lines in the sense that you did see pushback during the early part of the hearings, and I only caught the really early part of it before I got interrupted with something else. And Barr basically was saying, as Don was indicating, saying, well, look, ask Mueller, was there anything inaccurate in what the summary that he released was? The answer was no. But Mueller's position is basically insufficient context, not enough information. And as far as the summaries that apparently Mueller or his team prepared, that, you know, who knows why exactly Barr didn't release those rather than his own. I didn't catch that, if that was one of the conversations that came up. But it could have been a situation where Barr basically said, look, let's just keep it short for now. We know we're going to release the whole thing later. And that's why, to a certain extent, I'm not overly anxious about this whole issue, because we have the whole report in front of us at this point. Mm-hmm. And certainly some of the senators were starting to question Barr along those lines, saying, okay, did Trump, for example, really give full cooperation? You know, what's the issue on the word use of spying? So they're starting to dig into some of the specifics in the report. So whether it was a four-page summary or a multi-page longer summary that was released at this point, I don't know that it really matters that much.
Mm-hmm. Well, the president himself did jump on this as an exoneration when the report does not conclude that. When the redacted report was released, it showed Mueller believed significant evidence existed that Trump had obstructed justice. But
well, let's keep one thing, keep that distinction between the two parts of it. Volume one of the report talked about the Russian collusion issue.
Right.
And that one basically was the exoneration, no evidence of that. Yes, Trump had some, or Trump's advisors had some meetings, but nothing really came of it in the sense of what we were thinking. Again, collusion is not a legal term.
I mean, just to be clear, are you saying there is no evidence or not enough evidence for a prosecutor to bring an indictment?
And no evidence in terms of any of that kind of collusion going on. Again, collusion is not a legal term. But where the report did hammer Trump a little bit more, and so Trump's saying that no collusion or no obstruction, that maybe is a little bit I want to phrase this to be generous to both sides, that that there was maybe some things going on that Trump did that would have been considered, well, something in the neighborhood of impeding, let's use the word, the investigation, not necessarily obstruction, because that has a specific legal meaning, that there were some things going on that Trump certainly wasn't happy with the investigation, but there didn't seem, according to Barr, to be sufficient intent to be able to charge that. And so that's where you get into more of the issue that you're saying, is that, mm-hmm. well, is it that there was no evidence or insufficient evidence to charge, which is a lower bar, of course, small b, 1R, than actually convicting somebody, which is beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Donna Hoffman, do you see it that way?
Well, you know, one of the things that we need to understand is that this is not a done story, because Congress still has investigatory power here. And they can also make a determination on obstruction of justice. And that is what some of the investigations, in particular before the House Judiciary Committee, may be delving into in future witnesses that they're calling. And, you know, Barr is maybe going to appear before the House Judiciary Committee tomorrow. There's differing views of opinion as to how that testimony is going to go forward, as I understand it. I don't think that has been resolved yet. But this is one of the jobs of Congress. And so far, the White House has not given any additional evidence or requested evidence that has been requested by Congress. Congress has also not gotten the full Mueller report. No one has gotten the full Mueller report. What we have is the redacted Mueller report.
Mm-hmm.
Congress wants that, and they want the supporting evidence that the Department of Justice has related to that as well. Remains to be seen if that's going to be forthcoming. So Congress still has a job to do as a co-equal branch of government in terms of Barr has made his determination in terms of obstruction of justice. Congress can make a different determination, but before they even do that, because they don't have the information to do that yet, they have to do the investigation. And this is something that really needs to be protected, because Trump has been on record saying, oh, it's over. Mueller's done. They didn't find anything. We need to move on.
Mm-hmm.
I think Lindsey Graham maybe began his statement this morning in the Senate Judiciary Committee with something about moving on. But Congress still has a job to do in terms of investigation. And now there are court cases going forward on this. And there's multiple levels here, not just one thing that Congress is wanting documents on. We have tax returns. We have various issues that they're trying to investigate. And if they don't have the documentation, that investigation is being impeded. And that is one of their core responsibilities in terms of oversight and also in terms of their doing legislation, because they need to be able to find facts in order to potentially write legislation to make correct behavior, do various things in terms of how information does and does not flow both to Congress and the American public.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa are two political scientists on this edition of River to River. If you'd like to join us with your question, thoughts on the redacted Mueller report, the Attorney General's testimony today in Washington, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions for Tim or Donna. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Tweet Iowa Public Radio. Let's talk a little bit about how the public sees this, referring to a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, a poll showing how Americans are split along partisan lines. Surprise. On a number of issues related to on a number of issues related to the investigation into Russian election interference. Overall, pretty much right down the middle, 48% of Americans think Democrats in Congress, exactly what you were talking about here, Donna, should continue investigating Russian election interference, compared with 46% who think the investigations should end. Now, on the question of impeachment, most Democrats want impeachment hearings to begin now. 7 in 10 Democrats want Congress to begin those hearings based on the findings of this report. Just 39% of Americans think impeachment hearings are the correct step overall. So, Tim, what are the arguments for Democrats for and against in the House right now with impeachment? We know Nancy Pelosi has steered away from calling for impeachment at this point.
Right. Well, in terms of the for side of things, is that, well, many people believe, and this apparently is shown in the polls, that Trump obstructed. Now, the collusion issue, that's, again, probably set that one aside for the most part. But the obstruction is the one that seems to have a little bit more weight behind it, that he has done things that would seem as this considered obstruction. And one of the things that I sometimes tell my students is that, you know, lawyers for the other side, whatever the other side happens to be on an issue, will often do things, have motions, things of that nature to impede some investigation. The question is do they go too far at a certain point? And if you have a situation, as Trump believes, where there's no underlying crime, do prosecutors give them a little bit more leeway? Well, again, from the Democrats' perspective, this isn't a legal issue, it's a political issue, and so you don't have to reach necessarily the same levels of evidence in terms of whether it's probable cause or beyond reasonable doubt to reach that. And so that's why they want the investigation to go forward, and not just with respect to obstruction, but you're getting people looking into Trump's finances because he won't release his taxes, things of that nature. The negative side, though, has to do with, again, the political aspect to this, is that will, in fact, this hurt Democrats if they push forward? Will it look like they're just like stalking him, or that they're going too far? And the lesson that some Democrats, and perhaps this applies to Speaker Pelosi as well, is they're saying, well, look what happened to the Republicans when they impeached Bill Clinton back in the 90s, mm-hmm. is that it really hurt them in the later elections because public thought that they had gone too far in terms of pushing Clinton, and Pelosi and some other senior Democrats may feel the same thing could happen to them if they are perceived as going too far with regard to trying to get Trump, and that perhaps their focus ought to be, rather than getting him in terms of an impeachment, because he won't be convicted and removed given a Republican Senate, just focus on 2020 and having him unelected, so to speak, instead.
Donna Hoffman, how are you seeing Democratic Party leaders and the 2020 presidential candidates in the Democratic column grappling with the approach to this issue as we get closer and closer to 2020?
Well, I think in respect to the presidential candidates, they're kind of feeling their way along this fairly carefully. But to speak to Speaker Pelosi's statement here, you know, we need to think about what she said. Now, she's saying we shouldn't do impeachment proceedings. Well, one would probably not expect the House to immediately begin that. What that process starts with is, again, those investigations, and those are going on. should those investigations uncover new information, then this is a, you know, a progression into a political process that is impeachment. So it's not surprising, I don't think, that Nancy Pelosi, who's very smart politically, would say, look, we're not pursuing impeachment at this time. But, however, what the House is pursuing in particular, because that is where impeachment starts, is gathering evidence and having hearings that aren't impeachment hearings per se, but are still investigatory hearings that might lead to something. And part of what you have, some people I've seen in various punditry forums, people who were involved in the Watergate hearings, for example, will talk about parallels to today and Watergate, and that for the public to actually understand the evidence, they have to see that evidence. And one of the ways that they saw that evidence, at least as it's as it related to the Watergate hearings, was in fact in those hearings that were televised. And so, you know, Nancy Pelosi, I think, is being very politic here, which, you know, is a synonym for shrewd, in that she's saying, no, we're not, you know, progressing with impeachment. But what we are progressing with are investigations.
Harkening back to this NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, Americans evidently not very impressed in Congress's efforts to combat Russian interference since the 2016 election. Remember, this is the whole seed of the business here. Only 19% of Americans think Congress has done a great deal or a good amount to ensure there isn't interference in the 2020 election. Tim Hagel, do you see Congress stepping up to the plate here to ensure that our elections are not interfered with by Russia or other foreign powers?
I think, unfortunately, the short answer is no. That certainly there are things that are being done and undoubtedly are being done behind the scenes, because sometimes you don't want to tell the other side what exactly we're doing to try to keep them from interfering in our elections. But whether they're doing enough, it's hard to say, again, partly because of the secrecy behind it. But the focus seemingly has been on Trump, has been on now the obstruction and so forth, and that they're not really talking enough about what was not done in 2016, partly because that then begins to implicate the Obama administration, but also what's being done now, that there are various concerns in terms of strengthening, particularly as more elections are going to electronic means, and concerns that that can be hacked in some way, that a paper ballot could not. But of course, we know about various problems with paper ballots and different voting types of machines in various places. So we're in kind of a tough situation. And at least publicly, it doesn't seem that enough is being done, although you do see various states and various places, Iowa and some other states, that are sort of looking forward and trying to do what they can in terms of ensuring electoral integrity from their own perspective.
Donna, does the public should the public have confidence that our election in 2020 will not be interfered with?
I mean, I think we should, because generally speaking, elections in the United States are administered fairly well. Now, because elections are decentralized, here's the problem with the question that you just asked me, basically. Because elections are very decentralized in this country, you can have pockets of areas where you have problems. And so we states in particular try to take care of those things. So state laws affect this, but also federal laws affect this as well. And so if you're a foreign entity and you want to meddle in American elections, there's lots of opportunities for you to do that because of that decentralization. However, you know, states have been probably a little weaker than they ought to have been in protecting against this. They're on the alert now, I think, and that is good for the integrity of our elections. But certainly I think more could be done to help ensure the public's confidence in that. In part, as Tim, you know, noted, there's some things you just can't tell the public that you're doing. But there do need to be some efforts, I think, to reassure the public that election integrity is something that's high on the list of various authorities that are charged with that. And again, you have state secretaries of state, you have various things going on at the federal level to try to keep the integrity of the election safe. But when the public has questions there, this really becomes a problem related to the accountability of elected officials, how much, you know, faith we put into government even being legitimate. And that really can progress pretty quickly to a point that we really in this country don't want to see. And so everything possible needs to be done to protect that integrity.
Tim Hagel.
Just one quick thing on that. Don and I were both talking about sort of the electoral integrity, voting machines, all that kind of stuff. But one of the main ways that Russians interfered in the 2016 election was more information.
Right. You know, you have social
bots,
media.
Social media, bots, mm-hmm. whatever it happens to be, that puts out fake news and spreads it in various ways. And that has to be dealt with, too.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ben, I would add there, the greatest guarantee there that you don't get election meddling is for citizens to do due diligence in terms of the information that they are receiving and to not receive their information from social media primarily.
Right. Well, to be critical of that, to look at the sources for their if they're their news. Let's talk quickly before the break. Former President Joe Biden, just a few days ago, declared his candidacy official. Now he's on a swing through Iowa this week after announcing that bid for the White House. His first stop in the state was at the Veterans Memorial Building in Cedar Rapids. We have a bit of tape of former President Biden. IPR's Kate Payne was in Cedar Rapids yesterday, where Biden was highlighting growing the middle class as a focal point of his campaign.
Today, in Iowa and around the country, things have changed. I think the moral obligation of our time is to rebuild the middle class. That's my North Star. And the reason for that is when the middle class does well, everybody does well.
Okay. Talk briefly, Tim Hagel, about the launch of former Vice President Joe Biden's candidacy here. I'll get it right.
he had a good one that people were getting a little anxious, I suppose, as to get him to make a decision. I don't know if anybody at this point was waiting that maybe wanted to get in, waiting for him to make his decision. But I think the strategy ended up being good in the sense that he sort of waited for other people to kind of make their case. And there was some anxiousness among a number of voters saying, well, is this person good? Is that person good? They're not really breaking out. And is sort of a star quality, and so Biden kind of comes in. Now, we'll see if he's able to maintain that, but he had a very good first day numbers in terms of fundraising. He had a good bump in the polls. Some people say, okay, he's got these other problems. He's on an apology tour, but if he can maintain that and sort of appeal to that middle class, maybe a little bit more moderate group that some people were looking to, that he may remain strong.
Okay, 30 seconds for you before the break, Donna, on Joe Biden.
I agree with Tim. He had a good rollout. You know, there was a lot of anticipation building up for him to run. And now, of course, he is. Problem is, he's one of 20. However, he has good name recognition, and that's largely why he's on top of many polls right now.
Okay, we'll be back with more political analysis from Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. It's Politics Wednesday edition. You're invited to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll certainly talk about the 2020 candidates. There are 20 of them now with the entrance of Vice President Joe Biden, the former vice president, being in Iowa this week. But we'll talk about a number of other topics, including politics and faith. When we come back, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, Marathon Relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
With more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer with our political analyst this week, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Good deal of the first half hour. We discussed the Russian investigations, the Mueller report. Of course, the Attorney General still testifying before Congress, before the Senate tomorrow, perhaps before a House committee, but today it's the Senate. Thoughts from Donna and Tim on that in our first half hour. Before we move on, let's go to Scott. Scott joining us from Des Moines, I think listening to that first half hour, wants to chip in something. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Hey there, Ben. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. You're welcome to the program.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
My comment today is whether the Democrats in the House want to go forward with just investigations at this point or impeachment, I'm going to let the political expertise of Ms. Pelosi stand in on that. But I guess I just want to make a comment on the fear that people feel like Democrats might have how Republicans, when they attempted to impeach Bill Clinton, kind of backfired, because Bill Clinton was essentially covering up with an affair. And we have that with this current president and just a laundry list of other items. So I don't know if it's fair to be able to contrast those two things together, but I'd love to hear your panel's thoughts on that and all the things that we could also look into for investigations for this current president.
All right, Scott in Des Moines, thank you. Donna, perhaps to you, to what extent is that parallel? I mean, it's been talked about, the parallel Newt Gingrich going after Bill Clinton and then Bill Clinton being reelected and enjoying some quite high popularity in the polls following that impeachment.
Sure. So, you know, there is a quality, I mean, the caller's right. There's a qualitative difference here in terms of the nature of the alleged wrongdoing here. And so, you know, one of the things to point out about Clinton is that he achieved his highest public approval rating of his presidency the week that the House of Representatives impeached him. Mm. So the public did turn against Republican members of the House in that regard. And Gingrich in particular suffered personally because he would be essentially forced to resign after some own allegations of wrongdoing there. But, you know, in terms of electoral defeat of Republicans after the impeachment, you know, the Republicans won the presidency in 2000 and they drew the Senate to a tie in that particular year and maintained control of the House of Representatives. So there are some parallels, but also because it was, you know, impeachment investigation, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors is really pretty broad. It can be personal. It can be political. But there are also some, you know, interesting differences there. And, you know, it's really Congress's job, but the public's job, too. To think about those things carefully, because this really is something that should be involved. We should be having a national debate about this because it is incredibly important in terms of the balance of power and how much power Congress has and how much power the president has.
Mm-hmm. You had something on this, Tim. Let's move on to talk a little bit about the intersection of faith and politics, the White House preparing to host religious leaders for the National Day of Prayer. That's tomorrow, an annual event in which people of all faiths are encouraged to pray for the nation. The family leader, Iowa's leading conservative Christian organization, invited top seven candidates in a Real Politics polling to join to participate in its annual summit coming up in July. Let's listen to the leader of the family leader. Bob Vanderplatz is head of this Iowa-based conservative organization, the family leader, deciding to invite seven Democratic presidential candidates for a forum ahead of the 2020 election. It's an unusual step, he admits it, you'll hear here, for an organization that usually welcomes Republican candidates. NPR's Michelle Martin spoke with Vanderplatz about this decision.
Well, there's not a Republican primary, so we thought we'd go to where the game is, and that's on the Democrat side. But really, if you listen to the candidates, they're talking about the same things. One is they want to be about unity, bringing the country together. And we thought, why not give them an unusual forum or invite them to an unusual forum to basically cast a vision of unity? But then many, Michelle, are talking about their faith and how their faith motivates them, how it drives them. And our leadership summits have always been about principle over politics. We want to get to know about a person's faith. We want to get to know about what motivates a person, what drives them, and then how does that translate into policy and politics and governmental leadership. So we invited the top seven, as was polling right now, former Vice President Biden, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. We'd love it if all seven would say yes.
Well, I think, according to the last tally, five of them have declined that invitation. Biden and Sanders not responding yet, according to the latest information I have from reports of the family leader. Five, though, declining that invitation. Gives us an opportunity to talk about this organization, the family leader, Tim, and how much sway it has. Admittedly, they're looking for a way in, because when you have a Republican primary, as we did a few years ago, where there were lots of Republican candidates, they have more sway than here. But still, they're putting a foot into the, in the door? I don't know how you want to
try to get their foot in the door. Sure. Well, it's, you know, it gives publicity for an organization to try to do something like that in terms of both the organization itself and the values that it holds and the ideals and so forth. But just in general, it's interesting that so many of the Democrats quickly said no. That you see this with both parties, that there are some places that Republicans won't want to go, or they're concerned that maybe it's going to be a setup of some sort, that, you know, kind of gotcha questions and things of that nature, as opposed to an opportunity to basically say, well, here is how faith influences my policy views or something along those lines, or here are the ideals that I get that I try to carry forward that are based on my faith, or however you want to do it. And I think that that really is an opportunity, again, whether you're talking about Republicans going to maybe a liberal organization or the reverse, in this case, that it gives them an opportunity to reach out to an audience that they normally don't get to speak to. And sometimes you can find some common ground in situations like that, but then sometimes you do see instances to where it does become kind of a setup and the person is embarrassed by it or something of that nature, and then that's why you get people refusing in the future.
Right. Donna Hoffman, a setup or a possible opportunity? We've seen Pete Buttigieg talk about his religious identity and actually going after the vice president for some of the things that he did as in Indiana, right? Donna, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Oh, now we can
hear
you. You're
okay.
Back. Sorry about that.
I am here.
Yeah.
it is a danger for the Democratic candidates.
And we have to...
And can you still hear me?
Yeah, we're good.
And
we're good.
But with 20 candidates and a lot of people wanting to do this kind of thing, they can afford to be choosy. So the question is, do they really want to gamble where there is a legitimate question? Now, the family leader is a known quantity in the state. And in particular, were instrumental in getting, in the retention vote of Supreme Court justices, getting them defeated after the Varnum decision that related to gay marriage in the state. And so this is something that the candidates have to weigh carefully. And, it would be nice if every forum that all of these candidates went to was open to all of the candidates. It can't be. There's too many of them.
Right.
That the moderators were... taking questions and not ambushing. But oftentimes it depends on who's doing this and if a media entity's involved, what the goal is. The goal may be to get viewers. The goal may be to ask gotcha questions. And any presidential campaign's organizations has to weigh these things carefully because they're being inundated with these kinds of opportunities. And so it's unfortunate for the public square debate that we can't have all of these groups, doing these kinds of things, but the candidates can be choosy. And here we're seeing that at least some of them are being that way.
On the other side of the equation, we have Donald Trump's campaign obviously also in the last few days wanting to energize their base of evangelical Christian voters. Trump's campaign manager saying the president was sent by God to save the country. The White House press secretary some time ago, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, thinks God wanted Trump to be president. The Secretary of State saying in so many words that he believes it's possible that Trump is on a holy mission to protect Jewish people from the threat of Iran. That on the one hand, but you have Donald Trump, a president who doesn't regularly attend church services, the allegations of extramarital affairs, the nonstop Twitter insults, and the efforts to close the southern border to migrants, the treatment, recasting rules for asylum. So, Tim, what are we to make of the claim by Trump's allies that his presidency is divinely inspired?
Well, some people are going to believe that, and they believe that basically that faith drives these sorts of things, and they see God in working in various ways to sort of reach out and guide various people, whether it's leaders or themselves and things of that nature. Other people take a slightly different view, maybe that the divine has a more hands-off approach to all of this, and so you can get into theological arguments along those lines. But there's no denying that some people feel that way, and then they will express themselves publicly. Other people may be saying, maybe I don't know if I like that particular expression, but there you have it.
Donna, does it surprise you if we had said several years ago before the candidacy of Donald Trump that the evangelical right would have this sort of leader with this sort of character profile, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, I think that is rather surprising. But, you know, we should also note who the people are that are saying these things. It's Brad Parscale, who's the campaign manager. Michelle Bachmann has had something along these lines. Sarah Sanders, you mentioned Mike Pompeo. You know, these are people within the Trump administration, the campaign, or closely aligned with that. Religious leaders tend to not go there. And I even saw something from Jerry Falwell Jr., who said, you know, we shouldn't credit God with good leaders, because then we have to credit God with bad leaders too. Mm. And so this notion of separation of church and state is, you know, kind of an enduring principle in the United States. And there are some religious leaders that believe very fervently in that, because they do not want the government interfering in their business, basically. Now, others have, you know, varying degrees on that spectrum there. But, you know, I was looking at this issue recently, and, you know, the American public, a plurality of them will say that, this is from a 2012 poll from YouGov that asked, you know, should the separation of church and state be absolute? And 41% of the public, which was a plurality, said that it should. And so, you know, this is something that the country has long wrestled with. How much involvement should there be in these various spheres? And it is oftentimes something that a lot of people don't agree on.
Mm-hmm. And also, certainly, when it comes to, I mentioned the southern border crisis, when it comes to asylum rules, the president just this week proposing new rules for asylum seekers, making it more difficult, making it more expensive for those wanting refuge in the U.S., certainly among religious people in this country. The Catholic Church split on this, a progressive wing of the Catholic Church, a more traditional wing of the, in terms of interpreting religious writings as in regards to asylum seekers. Now, these new rules include introducing a fee for applications, barring those who entered the U.S. illegally from working until their claims are approved. Of course, this is the latest effort by this administration to deal with this growing number of migrants crossing the southern border, many of whom are seeking asylum in the U.S. Tim, do you know, would this mark a dramatic shift in how asylum seekers are treated in the U.S.?
I'm not sure that it would. You're certainly going to get some pushback on these things. From the administration's point of view, they're likely trying to find ways that they can to limit the number of asylum seekers, in part because they feel that, and the numbers would maybe suggest that this is the case, that a number of people are gaming the system, so to speak, that people are coming here knowing how we treat asylum seekers as opposed to others who maybe get deported right away. But if you come here with a family seeking asylum, that you end up getting in line, so to speak, and maybe you don't actually have a hearing until 2 years down the road or whatever it happens to be, given the backlog, and that gives you an opportunity to sort of establish yourself in this country. And so if people believe that the administration believes that's gaming the system, they're trying to find ways that they can limit that, that's still within their legal authority at this point. And hopefully, from their perspective, they're still going to get Congress to pass some sort of legislation. Well, mm-hmm. That's probably not going to happen, at least while we have divided government, Democrats controlling the House, Republicans in the Senate. It's unlikely they're going to come together on something, and especially not at this point before the presidential election. We'll see what happens after 2020. But on the other hand, when you put these rules into place, they're going to be criticized, and it seems unfair to people that are coming here with very little or nothing to start with, and now you're going to charge them a fee. They don't have the money. What are you going to do with them?
Mm-hmm.
They can't work, so that means they're going to be put on, if they don't have a permit, they're going to be put on social welfare of one sort or another, and that's going to cost taxpayers even more. So there are pros and cons to both sides of this, and it's just not going to resolve the problem.
Donna Hoffman, how much of a departure do you see this as, making it more difficult, more expensive for those wanting refuge in the U.S.?
Well, certainly. But one of the things to point out here is the nature of the governmental process here. So Trump did this with a memorandum. That's not unusual. He's directing the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security to, within 90 days, propose these new rules. Now, when new rules are proposed, they just don't, boom, go into effect.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a 90-day comment period. Those comments have to be read. This is not something that Trump said, boom, make it so, and it is so. Now, having said that, the president does have some influence here. But this is going to be a really long process. And anything that the president does in one of these unilateral executive actions, like a memorandum or executive order, can't go against current law, subject to court challenges, subject to congressional intervention, which, in this instance, is unlikely that there's going to be any kind of comprehensive immigration reform anytime soon, I think. But the point here is that Trump could have also, you know, done this without a big splashy memo in this effect, too. And we even know that DHS was working on some of the things related to this already in terms of regulations. Mm-hmm. So there's a publicity value to this memo and a symbolic value to this memo. But one of the things that citizens have to be careful of is that the president can't just command it and it happens. Now, having said that, the president has power here, but there are other things in the governmental process that have to go through the workings here for this to actually be realized. And it actually takes quite a bit of time.
Let's talk in closing about this meeting yesterday between President Trump, Speaker Pelosi, and Minority Leader Schumer. The Democratic leaders say President Trump has agreed to a $2 trillion infrastructure plan, but there was no agreement on how to pay for such a wide-ranging and expensive proposal. Schumer addressed what he described as a very constructive meeting between he, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the President yesterday outside of the White House.
Obviously, the roads and the bridges and the highways, obviously water, but also a big emphasis on broadband, that every American home, we believe, needs broadband, an emphasis on the power grid so we could bring clean energy from one end of the country to the other, and several other issues. We told the president that we needed his ideas on funding, that the last bill he proposed, which A, was smaller, but B, took as much money away, and the speaker emphasized this, took as much money away as it put in, wasn't going to work. So where does he propose that we can fund this? Because certainly in the Senate, if we don't have him on board, it'll be very hard to get the Senate to go along.
Donna Hoffman, let me start with you. What real prospects do you see for this bipartisan infrastructure bill? Huge, but our infrastructure needs an update. I think that's a bipartisan concern. It's how to get there, right, and how to pay for it.
Certainly, but I mean, it is significant that they were able to meet and to even agree on this, especially as investigations in Congress are going on. But one of the things to note here is the difference in this meeting and the difference in a televised meeting that they had earlier in the year surrounding the government shutdown. And this is another thing to think about in terms of how government does and does not work. It is important sometimes for policymakers to be able to conduct negotiations like this behind closed doors, to be able to not continually be in front of a camera where their own particular bases can see what they are and are not wanting to give away. And so, you know, this is something that I think in our media age, oftentimes, and we want transparency in government, certainly, but sometimes it is important to get policymakers into a room together without cameras, without reporters, to talk about where they can give and where they cannot give in order to come to a compromise and in order to actually govern. So infrastructure definitely is an area on which Democrats and Republicans can agree. You know, in terms of governing the country here. However, the devil is in the details, and they put it in Trump's court now to come up with the funding here. And so this is a continuing negotiation. I think they've given him, you know, I think they've agreed to meet again in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So this is something that we should keep a watch on.
Tim Hagel, how optimistic are you? Do you share that mild optimism, if I can characterize it that way, this in this political climate on the eve of a presidential election year?
Certainly makes it tough, the environment that this is happening, and especially if you have concerns over the debt and the deficit and spending and tax cuts and things of that nature. Now, Trump may not be as hardcore in terms of not wanting to raise the debt limit and things of that nature as some other Republican presidents have been, but still he's got to deal with his own members of Congress and so forth, and they're not going to go along, especially Republicans in the Senate, necessarily with a huge amount of spending unless there's some corresponding reduction in other areas.
Right. And I don't know, the basic approach, Donna, is just different in how to pay for infrastructure, isn't it? The Republican versus Democratic view here?
Sure. It's going to be. I do think I read, though, somewhere that they agreed that raising the gas tax was off the table. That is something that hasn't been raised, I believe, since the 90s, that is often, you know, thrown out there. I think the Republicans maybe, or excuse me, the Democrats threw out there, you know, getting rid of the tax cut that Trump promulgated earlier in Congress. That's probably a non-starter there as well. You know, so I guess, you know, yeah, mildly optimistic, and at least they agree, right, that we need better infrastructure in this country and some attention paid to it. But again, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to figure out where that money comes from. And there is a finite amount of that.
Okay. Maybe they'll get a tip from the Iowa legislature and the Iowa governor. We had a gas tax put in place a couple sessions ago, right? And then that is paying for upgrades to our infrastructure, as far as I know. Well, thank you very much, Tim Hagel and Donna Hoffman. Tim is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Donna Hoffman, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, thanks for coming into the studio, and likewise to you, Tim.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
River to River is available as a podcast. If you didn't know that, you just need to subscribe to River to River using your favorite podcast app. It's a good way not to miss River to River, whether it's a politics day or any of our other weekday broadcasts. And it's a good way to share these discussions with others. Look for the River to River podcast. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can write us, email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.